Coming up on DMT, I chat to the CEO of SACEM, Hall of Fame songwriter Paul Williams, Peer Music's CEO, I cover the Global Repertoire Database and BitTorrent. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends, episode 135, recorded between the 3rd and the 6th of June 2013. If you're watching the video, you'll notice a lovely alternative intro that I recorded outside the Library of Congress in Washington DC yesterday, but the audio for it was pretty much unusable, so I had to re-record it here in London. So this week I was in Washington recording interviews at the World Creators Summit, which had been organized by CZAC, the International Federation for Authors and Composers Societies, which gathered speakers from all over the world talking about author rights, policy, copyright, keeping the creators firmly in focus. So a very interesting crowd that is different from the conferences that I've covered in the past, and I hope that will come through in the series of interviews I've lined up for you today, and I hope you will find them interesting. So again, this week, after last week's Asia special, it's a slightly unconventional episode where I line up 5 of the interviews that I recorded at the summit. You will find the other 15 on digitalmusictrends.com, probably from the middle of next week. Also, watch out for next week's edition of Digital Music Trends, where we get back to the news, and it promises to be a very interesting show if Apple delivers on the rumors that have been floating around in the past few days and launches iRadio. This week, we start with Jean-Noël Tron, the CEO of SACEM, the French Collection Society. Then I speak to Paul Williams, president of ASCAP and very well-known songwriter. And for those of you who don't know him, you should go and check out track 7 and 9 of the new Daft Punk album, because he's collaborated with them on that. Then I talk to Ralph Peer, the CEO of Peer Music. I also hosted a conversation with YouTube and the Danish Songwriters Guild on the Global Repertoire Database. And finally, I talked to Matt Mason from BitTorrent. I really hope you enjoy the show. Have a great week, and until next time. So it's a real pleasure to here at the World Creators Summit to be here with Jean-Noël Tron, the CEO of SACEM. So hi, Jean-Noël, and thanks for joining me on the show. How's it going today?
Hi, thank you very much. Just great. You know, the weather is nice in DC, and we are just with friends and family from the not only the music industry, but you know, every creators in the world, because CZAC represents more than 3 million creators, and it's a unique worldwide organization that we need to build on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting organization and one that people should know more about, I think. And so let's start talking about one of the big news at SACEM in the last couple of months, which is the fact that you reached a deal with YouTube. And so I wanted to ask you right off the bat, you know, are you happy with what came out of that? And what benefits do you think will bring to SACEM members?
Well, yes, we are very happy. By the way, over the last 10 years, we have signed hundreds of licenses with online services, whether it's about streaming or about downloading. And we are here to give access to our repertoire. This is what our members want. So you're right, we just signed 2 very important deals, one with YouTube, the other one with the mother company, with Google, who's, as you know, just about to launch some new very important products and services for their customers, because Android is, and soon will be, in about a billion devices in the world. So that's key. It's true that in some ways it has been described as a historical agreement for a society, because it covers more than 120 countries in the world. It's not only a deal for all the SACEM repertoire, and you know we represent more than 400,000 creators in the world, but it's also a deal we made for our partners of Universal Music Publishing International and for all their Anglo-Saxon repertoire that's covered by the deal too. The benefits for our members is very simple. It's to give them a better share of the value created by YouTube, thanks to the advertising revenues that YouTube derives from having music videos on its websites.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And so, talking about the importance of digital for SACEM, I was very struck this morning by your remark that you know the digital revenues of SACEM, actually most of those are not derived from online services but from other areas. So can you elaborate a little bit as to what constitutes digital revenues for SACEM right now?
Sure. It is true that in Europe we have some way of creating value that does not exist, for example, in the US. One is what we call private copy levy, which is a very, very good example of how copyright, how the right of authors, has been always on the move. At the beginning of the 1980s in Europe, following the German example, Europe adopted almost everywhere, the only exception being, I guess, UK and maybe Ireland, a provision in which they created an exception to copyright. Anyone can copy at home on any device. At that time, it was analog, like videotape. And today, it's any digital device, like, you know, your tablet or your mobile phone, but can be also your USB drive. And those industrials who manufacture these devices and who get enormous benefits from the possibility offered to the consumer to copy, they have to contribute to the creators industry. Altogether, this account for about $70 million US dollars for SACEM revenues. On the French market, altogether, this private copy levy account for about 200 million euros, so roughly, I would say, 240 million USD, which is less than, you know, 2% of the revenue of this industry. So it's really harmless against what some of them are trying to say. The second stream of digital revenues, knowing that the question is, where does this revenue come? This is what we call them digital revenues, because these are digital players, of course. So the second stream comes from the internet service providers. Why? Because in Europe, and especially in France the cable industry is weak, and almost 40% of the households get TV through IPTV provided on an ADSL line. And so these ISPs have, of course, to contribute through author's rights, so copyright revenues, and this account for roughly 50 million USD. So this accounts for 80% of our digital revenues. And then we have, of course, the online revenues coming from every kind of services, from Spotify to Deezer, from iTunes to YouTube. And this represents roughly 27 million USD. It's, of course, growing fast, but it is less than the 20% of the total, knowing that altogether digital revenues represents around 14% of our revenues at SACEM.
Yeah, sure. And looking at, you know, at Medium, you were talking about how collective management systems are for you, you know, the most effective way forward for creators. And because, of course, of the huge amount of power required to elaborate all the data and create the reports and you know, make sense of everything that comes back to you through both digital and analog services. So, how important is it for the European societies to be able to negotiate as one entity? For example, SACEM retains all the rights around that particular license that you issue. And how important is it for this setup to be like that, as opposed to perhaps the US, where publishers can decide to take away the digital rights or do different things?
Well, everyone has to remember that at the core of this phenomenal model of collective management, because we are a collective society, we are a non-for-profit organization, we are run by our members. I'm elected by a group of authors and songwriters and publishers. At the origin of it was a very simple idea that when you are an author or a songwriter, how successful that you can be, if you are alone, you're weak. You know, that's exactly like in any other kind of business, whereas something is collective, you know. You're a farmer, you have making milk. If you want distribution or, you know, big manufacturers of yogurts to offer you some kind of fair price for your products, you would better regroup with your fellow farmers' neighbors. And that's the model of every collecting society. The rules has to be in solidarity between the members. And as you know, all over Europe, we have something called exclusive assignment, which is that as a creator, as a publisher, you can perfectly choose to manage your rights yourself. No one is obliged to be a member of the society. And if you want to join a society, you can do it wherever you want. Some French important composers are members of other societies. And at SACEM, we are very proud, I must say, to have about 17,000 members that are non-French for 160 countries in the world. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is a society able to simplify the life of music users? Yeah. And what music users ask is to be sure that they can negotiate for the biggest repertoire that they can have access to.
Yeah.
And this is definitely the virtues of the model.
Yeah.
Definitely this is what differentiates possibly the European market and many other markets in the world from some other markets that what's happening in the US. And I think it's really a tough time for creators.
Yeah. And I was impressed today by your rebuttal of some perhaps sweeping generalizations that do happen quite often in this industry, talking about sort of how perhaps societies or other members of the music industry are stuck in the past, and how they need to embrace technology, and you know, very sweeping generalizations on how the industry is not moving forward. But of course, you come from a business background in technology, and so of course you don't stand for that, and you want to make sure that people know that as a society you are a forward-thinking organization, right?
Well, yes, I think we all try to do, and all my colleagues from all societies are doing the same. So, no, what I'm impressed, you know, I've been in this industry, I mean, the music industry for only a year, and something that really surprised me is how this industry is underestimated itself. Yeah. You know, the music industry tends to think that they have to apologize for something. But gosh, when it comes to the digital revolution, and as you said, I started my career working for the computer industry. Then I moved into the information system industry, and then I worked to develop the internet in France for 5 years. And then I've spent 5 years with a major telco. I was even the CEO of the mobile operations of this telco in France. I'm impressed by the fact that on all cultural industries and content industries, the music industry is the first one which really embraced the digital revolution. Everyone from, you know, authors and songwriters to major publishers or labels are today fully thinking in terms of being digital. So this is also the reason why I'm so straightforward in saying to some of our friends from, you know, regulators, politicians and some other industries, stop lecturing us. You know, we've been striving hard to make it possible for everyone, every digital player, to have access to all repertoires.
Yeah.
Today, any consumer can have access for free to millions of music works legally. So there is really no reason why today people should, you know, criticize society or our industries.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Looking at the technology sector, has the relationship with music startups, how has it evolved, and has it gone better, for example, in the last 3 or 4 years? And of course, one of the homegrown examples in France is Deezer. So how has that relationship evolved for you?
First of all, I want to say that all these players, whether they are Europeans or Americans, they really are partners for us. You know,
yeah.
We had a few months of tough negotiations with our partners from YouTube, but we made a deal. And I mean, we had all this discussion in good faith, and the goal was to have a deal. I was in LA and in San Francisco, in Mountain View, 2 months ago, and I spent hours with key players of the industry, newcomers also, you know, from Grace Notes to YouTube and from Google to Zephyr, which is a very dynamic startup that was created to manage rights online. And I'm impressed, of course, by this dynamism, but I'm almost more impressed by the fact that in Europe, where we don't have the key players like, you know, Apple or Amazon or Google, the only worldwide class digital player we have are Spotify and Deezer. And this is a lesson to be learned by Europeans, yeah. Which is that the fate of the digital industry in Europe relies on the content industry. And we should be proud of that, which is not often the case in Europe, you know. And this is also something we try, myself and many of my colleagues, to change. Make the people understand what the reality is, which is that we, the content industries in Europe, we are part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yeah, sure. And finally, the GRD project, the Global Repertoire Database project, is kicking off in earnest this year. And, you know, they're going to start setting up actual offices, and hopefully it's going to start bearing some results by 2015 or so. So are you optimistic about the project, and do you feel like it's a necessary step for the industry to take?
Oh, definitely. I hope it will be a success because the industry needs to find new solutions to improve the way we manage data altogether. And as you know, the GRD was established for that, and SACEM has been at the origin with some of our colleagues in pushing hard with publishers, digital service providers, and also creators to make this project start. When it comes to what will it be, you know, I started my career with Anderson Consulting, now with Accenture, so I tend to be always very cautious on big IT projects.
Yeah.
But so far, I guess we are on tracks.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time, and have a great rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
Great. I'm here at the World Creator Summit with Paul Williams, ASCAP president and chairman, as well as being one of the most acclaimed songwriters in the US and a member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. So hi, Paul, and it's really great to have you here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Great. So first of all, I wanted to talk about when you started out as a songwriter. You know, how important was it to find out about societies and about ASCAP?
You know, it's amazing. You can be protected by things you don't know anything about. It was wonderful because I was an out-of-work actor. I played little kids in movies, but I couldn't make a living at it. And I began to write songs for my own amusement. They began just as songs for my own amusement. All of a sudden, I met with a publisher. You know, I had something recorded, and that quickly I was in the middle of the music business and didn't know anything about it. But fortunately, I had a good publisher. I'm a great believer in strong and involved publishing.
Yeah.
And a good publisher said, you know, you know, we need to get you to join a performing rights organization. I started out with BMI for a few years and had a first couple hits at BMI, and then chose to move over to ASCAP. It felt like a little better fit, although I have great respect for the writers of BMI and some co-writers there, sure. And some songs that are still there. It's incredibly important because I don't have the capacity to run around the country while I'm writing songs and listen to all the clubs and see who's singing my music,
yeah,
who's performing my songs. I need somebody to represent me, and blanket licensing is a brilliant idea that has worked for many years.
Yeah, and we're talking about being protected by something you didn't know anything about. So how do you feel young artists are educated when it comes to these sort of matters, and are they paying attention to making sure they're registered and everything else?
They are. They're paying attention, but they're also being largely misinformed about copyright. And one of the things that we're trying to do at ASCAP is make sure that, you know, that we're very active in educating young writers to where they really see the value of copyright. They see that, you know, that their future, you know, really depends. And, you know, if you get lucky enough to have one of those lovely little pieces of music come out of you, or a bit of a lyric that the world responds to, and you have that heart connection,
yeah.
Because ultimately that's what it is. It's ultimately me listening to a song by Rodgers and Hart or the Beatles or Stephen Stills and going, oh, he's writing about what I feel. But you have that connection, you know. You get lucky enough to make that connection where all of a sudden your music is a part of people's lives,
yeah.
And continues, you know. I wrote We've Only Just Begun in 1970. We've Only Just Begun is still being played, thank you very much, once in a while. And it's so wonderful to know that can become an annuity for my family, that my children and my children's children, you know, can enjoy the fruits of my labor.
Yeah.
You're talking about uncertainty in the great keynote speech you gave earlier. And so uncertainty for the creators, of course, because of the current climate, but also the fact that, you know, on the positive side, the fact that creators are still creating and they really want to create. And, you know, that's yeah. what makes it great. And so talking about that, you also made remarks about how, you know, people are not really talking straight when it comes to copyright infringement and the issues around that. So what is your stance on that front of things, and how perhaps there should be more done to protect creators in this country as well?
You know, whenever any new platform for delivering music is created, ASCAP has had to step up to the plate and say that this is a performance. Yeah. You know, and we deserve to be properly paid for it. And we've been able to work out a viable working relationship with club first with you know, music performed live, then in the moving into radio, television, cable, satellite. At every level, we've been able to find a balance that is probably, you know, a great deal is one that we both walk away from going, yeah. And we're looking for that kind of a deal in the digital world right now. The real challenge right now is streaming, because, you know, and I am a huge fan of the technology. I love the fact, my wife is always screaming at me, stop staring at your hand, because I've always got my, you know, my face in that iPhone, yeah. because everything I need to know about the world is right there. But the fact is that when your music, you know, when your films, you know, when the entertainment of your life is provided in a streaming fashion like that, unless the creators of that entertainment are properly paid, the desire or the ability to continue to working, making music, making movies is going to disappear. And it ultimately, writing songs, you know, is going to become a hobby as opposed to a profession. Bill Withers had the wonderful songwriter Bill Withers was in Washington, D.C. with me. We were visiting a senator talking about copyright. And Bill Withers had one of the great lines of all times. He said, you know, Senator, you know, if we can't make a decent living, you know, from our music online, we're going to have to do something else for you. We're going to have to get day jobs. And Senator, you do not want Ozzy Osbourne as your plumber. You know, so I think that's a bumper sticker. And I think that's what we have to do is when you think about the young music creator, the young songwriter, composer that's beginning their career right now, for them to have a life and for them to be able to devote their life to making music, we're going to have to adjust the way that we are paid and the amount that we are paid.
Yeah, sure.
It's fair.
Absolutely, yeah. It's fair. And talking about the other great relationship that the songwriters have, you know, in their lives, which is, you know, on the one side the publishers and the other side the collection society. So, as far as publishing, you know, how do you see the industry shifting and adapting to the new technology as well?
Well, as I said, I think at the beginning of our talk, that I'm a great fan of great publishing. You know, yes. I sit as president and chairman of the board of ASCAP. I sit before a board that is equally divided of publishers and writers. The passionate involvement in the world of copyright and protecting rights is a challenge that's equally met by publishers and by writers at this point. I think that publishing is for many of us is something that we as writers, we started out as strictly writers. We, you know, as the years passed, I became more and more actively involved in my own publishing. But, you know, I not only got the business, you know, the business rewards from having a good publisher, but I also got the creative rewards. I had a publisher named Chuck Kay who would say to me, you know, that's a beginnings of a great song, but it's not done. That second verse needs work. I love that. I love the involvement of a good publisher in that fashion at all. I think that the world is our business world is offering some really interesting challenges right now, and the larger your team, maybe the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking at the relationship between ASCAP and you know, its counterparts in the US and also organizations around the world, do you feel like there is a cohesive sort of coming together of all these societies to make sure that all the money is pulled together and properly accounted for, and that you have a good relationship with everybody else around the world?
There's never been a moment of tension between ASCAP and any of the other PROs around the world. You know what? I think that we're entering into a time right now where more than ever you're seeing people link arms, and you know, there was a period when individual interests were, you know, were a little intense around all the elements of the music business. I think we're at a place right now where, especially amongst the PROs of the world, we realize we have common, you know, common challenges and common opportunities. You know, so CISAC is in fact, by its very essence, is about, you know, embracing the fact that we're in this thing together and working together to make sure that nothing stops the music. So my friends at IMRO and APRA and CESEM and around the world, there are great friendships and great working relationships. You know, and the fact is, when my music is being, you know, my music is being played right now in Paris, and thank you Jean-Noël for collecting my money and making sure that as a songwriter, that will translate to gas in the car to get me over to visit my kids.
Yeah, sure, and. I wanted to end by asking you about your collaboration with Daft Punk. Of course, it's a number one hit around the world, really. Like, the momentum is built incredibly. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, you've contributed to two of the tracks on the album. And how does it feel to be part of a mega streaming hit, which is really like one of the first truly global streaming phenomenons, as well as being, of course, a fantastic seller in terms of actual albums?
Well, you know, Daft Punk evidently became aware of me through a movie called Phantom of the Paradise, you know, which they claimed to have seen about 20 times. About 4 years ago, they played two beautiful pieces of music for me and asked me if I'd write lyrics. We talked about a concept of the album and the like. And then after I wrote the two songs, they asked if I would sing one of them. I put a vocal on a track. They disappeared and returned with this stunning album. And to see the fact that they've kind of gone back in time and forward in time at the same the same fashion. The album's like time travel for me, because it begins with this sort of Stevie Wonder-esque sort of great rhythms and all from the 70s, which inspired these great memories of that kind of music. But then, you know, there was a great scene at the end of Space Odyssey where Keir Dallea sees himself as an older man. And then he becomes that older man and sees himself as an older man. That's what working on this album was like for me, in a way. We worked together at A&M Records, which is now Henson Studios. So I'm in a physical location where I used to write 30 years ago or 20 years ago. I'm now working with Daft Punk. I've become a huge fan of their music. And they've taken EDM, they've taken electronic dance music. And I think while they haven't walked away from that, they've introduced their audience to Giorgio Moroder, to Paul Williams, to some interesting music from the past. They are the opposite of ageist. For me, at age 72, to be an active participant in a number one album of this type is a great gift.
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you have a great rest of the day.
I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.
Great. So I'm here at the World Creators Summit with Ralph Pierre, the CEO of Pierre Music. So, Ralph, it's great to have you on. How's it going today?
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Great. So let's start by talking about the legacy of Pierre Music. So it's a company that started out in 1928 and is going strong to this day. So what is your secret to keep a healthy publishing company running for such a long time?
Well, I think it's very important to balance the privilege of having a wonderful heritage catalog with the ability to be flexible and to move quickly to provide services in the modern world. And the two do mesh in many instances, and we're able to keep our heritage catalog fresh because we have a lot of younger people and executives who are very much involved in the contemporary market who understand that heritage catalog is very important to them, so they can view it from a modern point of view and work with updating it, with making sure it gets out there for synchronizations along with today's current hits, which is what everyone is always looking for until they remember there's something else that they might use. So I've been very fortunate that we've had wonderful executives along the way, who I've encouraged to make this blend of keeping in the contemporary market and to remember the songs from years gone by that are so important to us.
Yeah, sure. And it's all a question of making sure that the catalog that you have doesn't sit there idly, and it is actually used for the new generations, and in, if anything, in the long tail of the business, but it still brings in money. So
we make a very proactive undertaking to bring that catalog material along, because they're proven songs. Yeah. And if you go out today to get a proven song on the market, and that you're working with new material, you don't have that assurance that it's going to be as successful as these that have already passed the test, if you will, the test of time. And for instance, songs that everyone recognizes, like You Are My Sunshine, we're very, very active in getting them into ringtones and various new media usages, because if a new generation hears that music, it's going to be acceptable to them in the sense that they're already wonderful songs, and they'll wear it in their consciousness as they do with contemporary material.
Yeah.
So it's very, on the other side of that coin, it's very important that we remain active in the contemporary market, and we invest our efforts in doing so.
Sure. And looking at the technology sector, of course, because a lot of the talks that are here, you know, are revolving around the friction that still exists between the technology sector and the creative industries. And looking at your perspective from a publisher's point of view, when technology companies started working in music and music startups starting operating, there was a lot of focus on, of course, getting the deals for the master recordings, and perhaps publishing was, the awareness of what publishing was and how publishing worked for these companies came a little bit later. So how are you finding this market is evolving for you guys from a new technologist perspective?
Well, in terms of the new markets, I think you're aware that we were an angel investor in eMusic, which was one of the first platforms that gained any significant traction.
Yes.
In terms of selling pure digital play with downloads over the internet. And we had this strange model of selling a la carte tracks at 99 cents a piece, which has a resonance in years later. And I can tell you, probably because I was there, publishing figured early on the game as to how rights were paid for. At that time, the major labels felt that they were going to take advantage of the new realities, a new digital landscape, to control the music from what I would call a cradle to the grave, from production right through the distribution in the digital mode. And they were disintermediating the other sellers of digital product in the process, a little bit like how travel agencies have felt with the online availability of tickets. This was, frankly, it was unhealthy because they wouldn't license to us. They wouldn't license to any upcoming platform. So there was no platform at the time that encompassed the full range of music. I think at eMusic we had upwards of 85% of the independent material available in the United States, important acts like Fish and so forth, and we did well with what we had. But there was no place, no legitimate place, that the buyer could go to get the full range of masters.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think that was a reason why a Napster got so much traction, because that's very inconvenient to the consumer. So I felt the model was very good, and we had a payment structure in place that everyone was happy with. But when along came Napster, it was very difficult for us. As you know, that took several years in litigation. We were a plaintiff as Pure Music in the case because we, of course, weren't being paid, and we felt we and our composers ought to be paid for the uses. But my view of Napster is not so much the hundreds of millions, maybe more, of dollars that were lost to the licensing community, to the rights holders, to the creators, but more what it did for the point of view of the next generation, that the marginal value of a digital copy of a song was nil. And it really created a value pricing scenario. You know, that term is when you value an item by its price. A quarter ounce of Chanel No. 5 cologne or perfume is not going to really be worth 100 euros, but that's what people pay for it because of the image it's created. Well, we had the same issue, I think, with music, except it was the other end of the spectrum. The value that was associated was nil. And that was a most unfortunate occurrence, because up until that time, there might have been a few complaints, but most people in the tangible world did not feel music was overpriced for what you got. And it was not a complaint we had a lot. So I think that was really the greatest impact of the online world. Recovering from that has been long and hard, and I hope it's going in the right direction. When you say there's friction between the two, I'm not quite sure that's accurate, other than the normal frictions that would be addressed between a buyer and seller of almost any price, almost any item, be it tangible or intangible. Their pricing discussions are what's really going on. And those are particularly difficult when new music business models flourish or come to fruition anyway every day, and you're looking for a fair licensing approach to that, and you consider all the possible downsides, and when you're in our position as a content owner, and it means we're particularly cautious about issuing those licenses, which is probably not a good thing, but hard to get over.
Sure. And you're also vice president of the NMPA, and copyright, of course, is what, you know, brings us all here, and what gets this industry working and produces the you know, the value that the societies and the publishers can then get out of the music. So one of the key issues at the summit was the fact that in the US there might be a review of the copyright, which might, as it was illustrated, it'd be done step by step instead of just taking a view of the whole thing, because that would take far too long. And do you think that there are dangers? Because, of course, when we talk about bills, there's always a danger that just a change in language, a change in a comma or something like that would alter the way in which your rights can be exploited. Do you think it's feasible to foresee a positive outcome to this review if all the parties come together in a sort of positive manner?
Well, I think it's unlikely the parties are going to come together in a positive manner, because the forces that be that are encouraging this copyright review have a very definite viewpoint that protection of intellectual property per se is inappropriate for the modern economy. And I personally think that's both short-sighted and foolish, because if you don't value a creator's output, something real, you are saying something about the way creators are handled or treated within a society. And I like to think that our society is very much enriched by the fact that over years creators have been encouraged, and through commercial terms, because although there certainly are some creators that create for the sake of creation, for the sake of beauty, if you will, and I have every respect for that, the fact of the matter is that if you can't concentrate on your art and you really are doing a number of other things in order to sustain your livelihood, you're not going to be able to hone it to a place where the public finds it acceptable, where you're able to do new things with it. And it's a great loss for society when that happens. And I think those are the two issues that are at play in revamping copyright. There are a number of smaller issues on which I think we will be able to find common ground, such matters as orphan rights, for instance. That's a very good point. And the reason it becomes a point, and that point being, of course, that there are works you can't identify, how do you license them? And we need to come up with a process whereby that can happen, is that for the first time with the digital economy, we're able to provide an opportunity for those works to get to the public. It was very rare indeed that a work that had no commercial potential and was therefore, because it had been lost or is lost because it never had commercial potential, that those works would be of interest or use, even in scholarly areas where they didn't have to pay copyright anyway. So that's being driven by that. I think it's good that there's this interest in a wider range of music. I think we need to come up with a solution for it. So there's an example of a sidebar which probably will be able to be saved and presented as useful to all parties.
Yeah, well, a positive development, sure. And looking at the international scene, and you know, of course, we have societies from all over the world. How are your relationships with services that are outside of the US, and you have a lot of dealings with, for example, either startups or new digital services that come from countries other than Europe and North America?
Well, to answer your first question, Peer Music operates in 27 countries, and we have relationships with societies in all those territories. In a number of places, our executives have participated at a board level in those societies and work with the composers and the management of the societies. So we have a very strong relationships with them. As I said in my panel this morning, we certainly find that some societies are better at providing value than others are. But it's a range of propositions, and we'd like to work with those societies that we don't find are that helpful to bring them more to an area where they're really doing their job on behalf of creators worldwide. One of the aspects you have with an international society system is that many of the works being represented by any given society actually come from authors and publishers who are in different countries. And those people do not have immediate representation on the boards of the local societies. So we and other international publishers find ourselves always thinking about that element of what the society is doing. And sometimes people have to be reminded that it's their privilege to represent these people, and they have a duty towards them.
And finally, what is your impression on the summit itself? It's a pretty interesting place to be, because it brings together creators from all over the world and societies that represent creators from all over the world. And is it your first time here? And if not, how have you seen the event evolve?
Well, I've been present at congresses sponsored by CISAC for many years, and they're always interesting for exactly the reasons you mentioned, that you have the viewpoints from individuals from all over the world. I think this particular summit in Washington is more interesting than many I've attended, simply because the new business models are coming to the fore. And at the same time, we have a little perspective of time of the difficulties in the digital environment of licensing and handling so many additional transactions and so many different types of licensing requirements.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for your time, and have a great rest of the day.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Great. So I'm here at the World Creators Summit, and we're going to have a bit of a discussion about the Global Repertoire Database, or GRD. So first of all, we've got FX Natal, who is Product Specialist at YouTube / Google, of course. And then we have Niels Mosmugard, who is Vice Chair at the Danish Songwriters Guild. So hi, guys, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hey, super. Hey, thanks.
Super, yeah.
Great. Awesome. So so first of all, let's talk about the importance of the GRD. The project is kicking off in earnest. You know, it's been in the works for quite some time, but now, you know, quite recently they announced that they're going to open some offices. And so it's the thing is really starting to kick into gear. So first of all, FX, what's your take on the GRD, and why is it important for somebody like YouTube?
So without a joke, it's really music to our ears to have the GRD. We are very dependent on the data to be able to monetize the content for the benefit of the creators. So we need to identify who owns what. And we're talking about 5 million works worldwide on about 100 territories. And so it's a lot of data and a lot of resources to actually identify rights holders. So when the GRD comes in, which will be this database where we can identify the publishing and the author's rights, we couldn't go there and clearly identify where to go for a license. Yeah. And this will change our business completely.
Yeah. And Niels, from your perspective as sort of representative of the creators community, what's your take on the GRD, and why do you think it's important?
Well, I think it's important of many reasons, actually. Mainly because we have this merging of data, the publishers and the societies, as FX is telling about. So we have this authoritative bank of data. One thing, it's very important in a multi-territorial licensing world. And then I think it's very important and a very productive thing that we meet, the creators meet with the licensees, with the societies, with the publishers, being in the same room, having to make consensus about the problems we have, instead of pointing to each other and say, well, I mean, he's walking down the street, but I wouldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
Now we have to meet and have serious discussions. One must say that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you know, with this end of the requirement and design phase that we are signing off in 2 weeks or something like that, we have made some agreements. This is how we think it should look like right now.
Yeah.
Let's move forward with this. Like, let's try to build it. And when we start working with it, let's see if it's the right way. Is there something we need to change?
Yeah.
So two very different things, but I think they're very important.
Okay.
And so in terms of the history of the project, so when do you first hear about this and how long have you been involved?
So it's been a couple of months now. So the project has been active for a year and a half, 2 years maybe, since its very early stage of conceptualization. And we've been deeply involved in that recent phase that lasted about 6 months, where thankfully the licensees that I represent here were invited to actually, you know, provide some input and understand the requirements that we have. And so the publishers and societies could take our needs and integrate them into the project. So it's been very, very helpful.
Yeah.
For us to really be able to participate.
Yeah, sure. And from your perspective, you know, how long have you been involved, and do you think, you know, how do you see the project shaping up for the future as well?
Well, I've been involved since October last year. I'm a representative of EXA, the European Composers and Songwriters Alliance, and well, I heard about GID in the very beginning. Someone from the working group of the parliament visited our meeting at EXA and told us about it, and we all were very suspicious. Oh, I was very suspicious because it seemed so huge and unrealistic in some ways, and we had those looking at it and it looked like the publishers, the majors, would be there, and oh, they would take all the benefits, and so. But during the 2 years, I think it has been progressing. It sort of changed, and in October, the EXA people asked me if I would go to have a seat there, and I think it's been very interesting and very good.
Yeah. And it feels like the timing as well has. It's been right, because when it started, the problem wasn't quite as acute as it is now. And you know, in the past 2 years, more and more we feel the need of a database of this kind. And you were talking about, you know, the sort of matching and some of the numbers that YouTube does, and it's insane.
Yeah, it is insane. Look at it from a certain perspective. But what really triggered the whole need is the implementation of the pan-European licenses, or what I should call the multi-territorial licensing.
Yeah.
So we are exactly at a turning point in the licensing, at least in Europe, but it's growing worldwide, where major rights holders are now providing licenses on a multi-territorial basis.
Yeah.
And this impacted on the fact that we need to identify the repertoire that is being licensed.
Yeah.
So when a publisher tells us, okay, you can have my repertoire, then we, okay, which repertoire? You know, what are these works that are being licensed? And this is where the GRD comes in to provide us with this authoritative information that we actually really need now.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking at the GRD as a project that was really started in Europe, what is the? How do you feel the involvement of the community worldwide is at the moment?
Well, we have made the decisions about location, and it's sort of Eurocentralized. The headquarter in London, the first operational center in Berlin, but obviously it the plan is to make it 24/7. So we need the Asian market is a completely different market. So you need the expertise of the Asian market, going to Japan or somewhere like that, and it's to the United States as well.
Yeah, sure.
We need operational centers everywhere.
And for you, for the International Collection Societies, do you feel like it's good for you guys to be in the same room with all the collection societies and all those stakeholders and discuss things in a problem focused manner, which I guess encourages relationships as well.
Yeah, problem focused or solution focused, maybe. No, they are major partners for us. Societies and publishers are really the key players helping YouTube and Google deploy its products. So it's definitely needed. And we appreciate the internationalization of the project. So right now, it is like most European-centric because this is where the need is urgent.
Yeah.
But the scope of the GRD is to integrate Latin American repertoire, Northern American, Asian, African. So it's really very broad in focus, but it's going to come in stages. So we're going to start with the European, as I said, the most urgent need. But we're looking forward to have the other more exotic on a U.S. perspective repertoire available also.
Sure. Well, that's great. Thanks so much for your time. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the next year and a half, 2 years, and see whether in 2015 we're going to see the database come out into existence.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Great. So I'm here with Matt Mason, who is the Vice President of Marketing at BitTorrent at the World Creator Summit. So hi, Matt, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, first of all, I want to start talking about BitTorrent's efforts in the past, couple of years to really become a partner of creators. So you've tried to fight the image that the creative industries had of BitTorrent as a company that promoted piracy and the associations that came with that. And so where are you in this road to become a partner of the creative industries, and where do you want to get?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, it's interesting because if you actually look at the history of BitTorrent, the company, BitTorrent's always been a partner of the creative industries, and BitTorrent has never, ever endorsed piracy. I mean, if you go back, BitTorrent's been one of the largest licensees of Hollywood content in the world, other than Netflix. In terms of where we're at today, we're working with all of the major record labels. We're talking to all of the studios about how we can help them and how the BitTorrent protocol and the existing BitTorrent ecosystem can both be used to add value to the business of creating a sustainable future for content.
Yeah. And one of the initiatives that has been talked about recently has been that of the BitTorrent bundles. So it's something that you launched that allows creators to present a bundle of different types of media. It can be anything really, and part of that is gated so that the artist or the creator can add any sort of level of unlocking level. So it can be an email, it can be a payment, it can be whatever they choose essentially. And this started with the artist Cascade in partnership with the label Ultra, and so I wanted to ask you, we're almost a month after the release of this bundle. Do you have any figures or sort of perspectives on how this first experiment has been going?
Yeah, I mean, overall, the experiment's gone extraordinarily well. Some of the guys from Ultra are meeting with some of the guys from BitTorrent in San Francisco today to sort of go over the sort of month's results. And we're going to be releasing those really, really shortly. But in a nutshell, it went really, really well. And the one thing we've seen sort of over and over again with these experiments is that our users are real fans, and they will reward creators for their efforts. It's just been a matter of figuring out, well, how do we make a solution that works for both consumers and producers that uses the BitTorrent protocol, and that's the thing that's taken a long time to figure out. But it feels like we're getting there. It's still very much in the experimental stage. We're not going to have the full publishing platform for anybody to make a bundle out until end of this year. But the early experiments and the early prototypes have been very encouraging. We're learning as we go, and it's been a real honor and pleasure to work with artists like Cascade.
Yeah.
To have got huge fan bases, so we can really road test the concept.
Absolutely. And do you plan on taking this as a campaign by campaign basis project, and then maybe eventually opening up to a wider base?
Yes, exactly. So what we're doing over the course of the next 9 months is testing different types of gates inside the bundle, just to see what works. What's the best thing to do? What's going to work for a DJ like Cascade? What's going to work for a band? What's going to work for a filmmaker, an author? How can we experiment? And we're always surprised by what artists want to do and how they think about monetizing their work, and how sometimes they think about just releasing work to encourage some kind of social action. That's something we're seeing as well. Some of the world's most famous artists have reached out to us in recent months, just said, I want to use a bundle just to get people to do something nice for each other or to make some art with me. Like, we never saw those kind of things coming when we really sat down to design the bundle. So it's, I think it's going to be interesting as a way to monetize and leverage value from your content, which is obviously the big problem. But I think, you know, but one thing that's been said often, I think Clay Shirky said it, is the most interesting thing about technology isn't the technology, it's what people do with it next. And I'm really excited to see kind of the cultural value that bundles create when you give artists the power to decide what a store should look like. And essentially, that's a bundle is essentially a store baked into a piece of content that the artist controls. So we're really excited about, it's not about what we're going to do with these bundles, it's about what the rest of the world will do with them.
And one of the aspects of BitTorrent that's quite interesting is the fact that it's actually a potential mean to really slash costs of distribution of digital content. And the majority of course content creators, even if they do a free campaign or anything like that, they still choose to go with the different providers that perhaps cost them quite a bit of money as well. So what do you think you can do as a company to promote the way in which artists can use BitTorrent as a distribution mean? And because it almost feels like right now it's still a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
To understand how you go about seeding something like that for somebody that is not really versed in that area, and so you're working towards more sort of front-end solutions for artists.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our products, I mean, they're not the easiest things in the world to use. They're definitely not the easiest things in the world to use for uploading content as an artist, and that's because we've always deliberately tried to make them not easy to use for piracy. Like, we've never wanted to point to illegal content, we've never wanted to endorse piracy. We didn't want to make it easy for people to create like a seamless content experience, because we just wanted to stay away from piracy completely. Now that we've got 2 million pieces of legal licensed content out there in the BitTorrent ecosystem, now that we've delivered close to 200 million downloads in the last 12 months of legal licensed content from BitTorrent HQ in San Francisco, now that we're seeing this critical mass of people who want to do this, we're just working as fast as we can to build a product that will let people do this. And you're absolutely right, the real value of BitTorrent is, we're really excited about the bundle concept, but the real value of BitTorrent is this completely takes away costs. We've got products in the market like BitTorrent Sync, which is essentially a way to sync computers with unlimited amounts of data between all your different machines that doesn't have any cost, none of the back-end costs associated with other storage and syncing services, because there's no cloud, there's just your computers. And really, that's the value of BitTorrent as a technology. And, you know, the way we look at it is, if you look at every disruptive technology in history, from filmmaking technology, going all the way back to when Edison invented the record player, the most disruptive technologies have always been thought of as kind of things to be fearful of at first. And, you know, it's really no surprise that the first 10 years of BitTorrent was, oh, this is something scary. Actually, it's one of the most valuable technologies we've ever created, and we're really excited about the new applications of BitTorrent that we're rolling out in the next few years.
Yeah. And talking about switching from the artist and the distributor's perspective to the consumer's perspective, BitTorrent has also of course, so we're seeing a drop in numbers of people that are using the P2P technology to pirate, especially music, because there's so many services that are more convenient to do that sort of thing if you need to find, you know, the artists that you love or find music that you want to listen to. And so how do you present BitTorrent now as a front-end solution for consumers to find legal content? And what is the best way to curate the content that is out there, as you talked, like huge numbers, to present to people BitTorrent as a discovery platform as well?
I don't know that we are seeing a drop in numbers. We're certainly not seeing a drop in numbers.
No, I meant a drop in numbers of people that are using P2P for piracy for copyright infringement.
I'm not totally convinced that that's true. The latest reports I've seen have suggested that the entire ecosystem is growing and a smaller percentage of the worldwide traffic is BitTorrent, but it doesn't suggest that the network's actually still growing. And whether or not it's all legal or illegal uses is really hard to actually ascertain because it's distributed. But in terms of, you know, what we're doing to try and make things easier for people, it really gets back to what we're doing with bundles and sort of releasing tools that are much more than clients for browsing the protocol, but actually content managers for consuming good content. We're doing everything in our power to point people towards good content. We launched an ad network last year, and really the whole point of that was we want to point our users to good content, and we point enough of them to good content that the people, games companies, software companies, creators of all kinds are actually paying us to point our users towards their content. So these users are really valuable, and they are mainstream consumers. But it's going to take us probably the rest of this year before you start to see some more sort of, you know, consumer friendly, very easy to use products, because we didn't want to build those until we were sort of sure that the ecosystem was changing. And the good news is that it really, really is. So
yeah, sure. And looking at finally the way in which fans relate to musicians, so what you're trying to build is also a way for musicians to establish a relationship with their fans, mm-hmm. because of course the fans need to be hit multiple times, and you know they need to feel like they're comfortable with the artist before they, you know, usually part any money or, you know, actually buy something from the artist. So where do you sit in that equation? Would that be more for the initial discovery phase, or would it be for sort of a middle ground where the fan is looking for stuff by the artist and they find it and they manage to get an added value through the bundles or through the torrent that the artist is seeding?
You know, what's interesting about all the experiments we've done in the last couple of years is what we really saw is that there's not a business model for digital content. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution that's just going to work for everybody. There's a different business model for every single piece of digital content in the world. And no one understands that better than the artist who created it and their fan base. So the idea of the bundle is we're going to give artists and creators the tools to configure a bundle that suits their business model. And if they make the majority of their money on iTunes, then the bundle will be a way to market and funnel people back to iTunes. Or if they make most of their money on YouTube, you can funnel people towards YouTube. If you want to monetize content directly, you can do so in that bundle. If you want to grab an email address from somebody and then market to them later and hit them multiple times, you'll be able to do that as well. Our point of view, our tagline is options, not rules. And we sort of look at the way the internet's evolving into a series of walled gardens, where there's, you know, one business model in this walled garden and one business model here. There's lots of really valuable platforms and stores and places that add value to content, but we don't believe in a one-size-fits-all solution. That's not the way the internet works, and that's not the way creativity works. So what we're trying to create is something that can really augment the rest of the existing ecosystem, including the BitTorrent world, but also all of the great social platforms, streaming services, music stores, video websites, everything else that's out there.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for your time, Matt, and have a great rest of the conference.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.